Hello and welcome to Series 13 of The Future of Drug Discovery. In this episode, Murat speaks with Tommy Tang, Director of Computational Biology at Immunitas Therapeutics, an immuno-oncology startup developing novel therapeutics for patients with cancer. Tommy is a prominent leader and communicator in the field of computational biology. He has dedicated his life's work to the acceleration of cancer research with expertise in analyzing large-scale bulk sequencing data, single-cell and spatial transcriptomic data, as well as epigenetic data. Outside of his career at Immunitas, Tommy is a brilliant science communicator and teacher, with various educational streams including Twitter, blog, GitHub repository, a YouTube channel, a newsletter, as well as authoring his own book called From Cell Line to Command Line. He is passionate about teaching biologists the computational skills essential for modern science. Tommy has had an inspiring journey into computational biology, as he believes that many others will need to develop bioinformatics skills in a frequently evolving landscape. So, take this opportunity to learn from the best, as well as learning how Immunitas are developing a discovery engine to aid the fight against cancer.
Hi, everyone. My name is Murat Tunaboylu. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Antiverse and your host for Future of Drug Discovery podcast. This week, I'm really excited to have the chance to talk with Tommy Tang, Director of Computational Biology, Immunitas, working on developing new therapeutics for patients with cancer. Welcome, Tommy.
Thank you, Murat, for your invitation. I'm excited.
So there are a lot of things to cover today, but in previous episodes, we covered a lot of stories where people start in the computational area and make, you know, some changes in their lifestyle and their career path to move into biology. I understand that you have a very similar story, but almost the opposite direction.
Correct.
Can we start there?
Sure, sure. Thanks, Murat. And yes, I have a very different story, as you mentioned, but let me go back to even my life before I come to the States and my childhood back in China. So I grew up in China, in a small town, south part of China. And it was a low-income family. My dad was a high school teacher. My mom was caring for me and my sister. I have a younger sister in China. And that's actually more than a full-time job, and it's a lot of work for her. And life was actually pretty harsh, actually, in the beginning. And I remember one day, it was actually even 1990s. There was one day we couldn't even afford some dishes, and we had like some soup with just soy sauce and some green onion. And I remember it very clearly. But my mom always tell me, like, Tommy, if you want to change your life, your destiny, you have to study really hard, and then only the knowledge can change your destiny. So I studied really hard, and I became really independent. And my dad actually also had a mental disease at that time, and we had to actually care for him as well. So that's how I also became quite independent, even when I was in a very young age. So I began to cook for the family, like, when I was in the third, fourth grade. But anyway, I studied really hard. I got into the best middle school, then get into the best high school, and then later get into one of the best college, actually, in Shanghai Jiao Tong University. Okay, that's like my life before I was in China. Then 2008, August 8th, I remember it really clearly. I came to the States because that was the day when Beijing Olympic Games start. So the date I remember really clearly. And I was on the flight. And I was pursuing my PhD in genetics and genomics at University of Florida. And I was trained actually in the molecular cancer biology lab. So purely wet lab. So I did a lot of PCR, qPCR, like Western blot, Northern blot, if you're familiar with the wet biology. And I did all of that. And then I think in the fourth year of my PhD, my advisor asked me to analyze this publicly available chip sequencing data. So it was around 2012. It was really popular method to investigate where the protein or transcription factors bind in the genome. Mm-hmm. I downloaded data. I couldn't open it with Excel and crash it. And I think it was only 2 gigabytes, something like that. And I realized, I need to learn some data analysis skills. So yeah, that's how I started. And in the beginning, I was really desperate because I asked for help. Like, okay, can you help me? Like, ask bioinformaticians for help. But they're always very busy. And of course, your work is not their priority. And I remember one day I was in an elevator and I was desperate asking this friend, can you teach me like bioinformatics? But then again, he was so busy and I couldn't. I couldn't actually learn from him. So I started to actually just learn by myself. Classes online, Udacity, Coursera, edX. At that time, those like MOOC platforms just began to actually become popular at that time. So I took a lot of courses there, bought a lot of books, and then of course a lot of Googling, and then hopping on those forums, seek answer, like BioStars. If you are in the bioinformatics field, you know probably those forums. So asking questions, I still can find my old questions like 10 years ago. Wouldn't I now see it? I guess it's a stupid question, but again, that's how it goes. And I learned quite a bit. In 14, 15, I joined MD Anderson Cancer Center as a computational biology postdoc. Really, I made the transition from a wet biologist to a computational biologist studying my postdoc at the MD Anderson Cancer Center. So I was mentored by Dr. Ro Vahak, who was at that time leading the Cancer Genome Atlas glioblastoma project. I had the experience to really play with those large scale sequencing data, like whole exon, whole genome, and RNA sequencing. At that time, still bulk RNA sequencing. Some bisulfite sequencing data, some chip sequencing data, some ATAC sequencing data. So I have like touched many different data types at that time. So that's around 2015, 2018, I moved to Harvard Faculty of Arts and Science as a senior bioinformatician, working on single cell RNA sequencing and single cell ATAC sequencing data. Mm-hmm. 2 years there, I joined the Shirley Liu's group at Dana-Farber. So there I was leading this big NIH-funded consortium project called CIDC, or Cancer Immunological Data Commons. So in that project, four cancer centers in the States, MD Anderson, Dana-Farber, Mount Sinai, and Stanford, carry out immunotherapy clinical trials. And they, in partnership with big pharma companies, and then they profile those patients using next generation sequencing, like whole exon, bulk RNA sequencing, and TCR sequencing, and ATAC sequencing. And I was leading a team of seven people at that time to process all the data, secure it on the cloud, and then give them back for downstream quality analysis. So it's about 2,000 some patients and 40 some trials. And then 2020, so it's almost 2 years, I joined Immunitas to establish their computational capability. So at Immunitas, our team is responsible for using single cell RNA sequencing and single cell TCR sequencing data to find new targets. And our company now is also in clinical stage. So our leading program, CD161, which is an antibody targeting T-cell and NK cell modulator, IMT-009. So it's targeting CD161, or the gene name is KRRB1. So we dosed several patients already, and then we're excited to see the results. And I really hope it can change the life of some of the patients. Yeah, that's where I'm now. So although I talked about like for like 3-4 minutes, but it's 10 years grinding, learning, frustration, relearning, but I'm really grateful for that experience. Yeah.
One of the reasons why we invited you for this show is actually that story, isn't it? I think it's inspirational, and you see a lot of biologists out there asking, how can I make that transition? So I understand that you did a lot of self-studies and you were motivated to do the switch, but you could have just taken a few courses and stopped there. What made you keep going?
Oh, that's a very good question. Well, yeah, so I think first you need to be really interested in something. And I think also, there are two reasons. I think last time I also talked about, if you want to learn something, either you really like it or you want to like stay away from the pain. Like at that time, I think I just had too much pain because I didn't want to beg, like, please analyze this data for me. Like everybody is busy. I think at that time, my reason was to get rid of the pain. So that's why I need to study really hard. Like after the lab work, I just turned on the computer like in the night, taking courses online and doing the exercise programming. And then gradually it can change, because after you do that, then you realize that I really like it. So if you really like something, then you will be persuaded to keep on learning and doing that. And for me, as you mentioned, I started to actually journaling like my journey, like some problems that I found and how I solved them. So I started the blog, like diving into genetics and genomics.com, so sharing like my own experience. And it turned out many other people had the same problem. For example, like they're Googling, what's the difference between different normalization RNA sequencing units like RPM or TPM? And I had a post on that, and it turns out it's really popular among the beginners. So that's how I started.
Would you say that, I'm glad that you made the switch when you did, but would you say that switching from a vet lab to a computational biologist, is it an easier transition now compared
no.
to like 2015 and so
on? Definitely it's not easy. Like anything takes effort. Great things take great effort. So, but I would say it's a little bit easier than when I started. At least now you have me, because I am sharing like my experience. And I, during the past 10 years, I collected so many resources, books that I read, and the courses that I think was really good. So I curate them in my GitHub repository. So you are free to go there and check it out, and at least you have a guideline to what courses to take. So as a beginner, I think the most difficult thing, at least for me, I even didn't know what's out there, like where to start, what course to take, what books, which books to read. And it just takes a lot of time and effort to gradually get the grasp or master of like how the field look like. Yeah. But I encourage people to actually make the switch, because biology is advancing so fast, and all the data, all the assay that we have is going to be high throughput. So the biology is going to be quantitative no matter what area you're studying. So you need some skills to like be able to actually manipulate the data, analyze data, extract insights from the data. So that's an essential skills no matter which field you are in. Yeah.
And have you been spending any time in the lab, or for the last couple of years, it has been a sharp transition to sitting in front of computer all day?
No, I actually made a switch during my PhD. So 4 years into my PhD, I had two first author papers, but they're purely biochemical based, like wet lab based. So, and I stayed, that's actually probably my strategy. I stayed for two more years for my PhD. So at the last 2 years, I actually probably 60-70% of like dry work and 30% like wet lab work. So, but then starting from my postdoc, I made the full transition, is a full computational biology postdoc. So I didn't do any experiments since then. Yeah. But I believe I can still pipette. If I go to the lab, I can still pipette. Yeah.
Other than, of course, solving or parsing that big Excel crashing file, what other, you know, success points you had along that journey that you can attribute to making the switch?
Well, that's a very good question. So I guess we all need to keep an open mind. Just keep an eye on what's out there. And I will tell you, like, one of my ways is to stay on social media such as Twitter or LinkedIn. And I believe at that time, like during my postdoc at MD Anderson, we wanted to actually process the whole genome sequencing data from TCGA, just reprocess them and then call the structural variants. And that's a very tough problem. And for whole genome sequence, you know, usually the raw FASTQ files would be like 300 gigabytes. And to process thousands of them, it requires a lot of computing power and also a workflow. So at that time, I didn't know, like I had some skills of writing bash scripts, but then I realized that it's not going to be like scalable because you have a thousand. Sometimes you run the tool, it gives you error, and you have to keep tracking it, like which one failed, and rerun it, because you can't run like a thousand at the same time. We're using the HPC at MD Anderson. And we have to actually submit 100 samples like every day, then like do this like for almost like a month, something like that. And at that time, I realized, okay, there's a tool called SnakeMake. It's a workflow language. I'm not sure you know, but now there are like other options. There are NextFlow, like others, a Widow, like from Broad, many other stuff. But at that time, like SnakeMake was really new to me. So okay, let me just write the pipeline because I can't just handle it with my batch script and also handle the scheduling, all the stuff. And I just learned it, like how to write SnakeMake. And then I started to we processed thousands of whole genome sequencing data, like using the pipeline. For each data type, I write a different SnakeMake pipeline, for example, for RNA sequencing, for ATAC sequencing, for bulk RNA sequencing, and then chip sequencing. And I have a pipeline for all different data types. And then you see, you never know whether it's going to be useful or not until like for the position in Dana-Farber. And for this project, they're actually using SnakeMake to process all the clinical trial data, like RNA sequencing, those like sequencing data. And what I learned during the past several years, like, turned out to be really useful for this position. So, And I would say opportunities will come, but you get to be prepared. Like, I never know it's going to be useful, right, for that particular position. Yeah.
That's a great point. And, you know, just going back to another thing that we briefly discussed, whether it is easier to do that transition now, and you said that you actually, I mean, contribute and help people to make that transition. We also know that you published a book on that topic.
Yes.
Would you be able to tell a little bit more on that?
Oh, yes. So during the past 10 years, because I started to write those blog posts, right, on my websites, how I solved this, how I solved that. Then last year, I realized that let me actually just put them all together as a book so other people can have a more clear roadmap to follow if they really want to make the switch. So I spent several months, and I think each day I take like several hours, like one or 2 hours, either in the early morning or in the night. So I put them together, and I cover a lot of things, like for example, Unix commands, like the first thing that you have to learn if you want to become a bioinformatician, because all the command line tools, I mean, the bioinformatics tools, they're written to run on commands. So you need to learn that. And I also cover a lot of things like statistics, like some Python, a little bit Python. I'm more like R person. And for data visualization and the principal component analysis, how to make heat map, how to interpret that heat map, how to design experiments, how to actually use, for example, snake make. So I just put all the contents in together in a book, like 400 pages, something like that. But it was relatively easy for me to write at that time because I just went back to my old blog post and look, what did I write at that time? And then just put them into the same category, like into different chapters. And at that time, I also, do you know this Gist thing? Like, so for GitHub, you can put your small like code snippet like on Git. And I also went back to look at my old stuff, like to see which one is probably useful for the audience. So I just take them and into the book. So yeah.
Okay. You have already done the work, the hard work, right? Then you kind of curate it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Will you do a sequel to that?
Yeah, exactly. I'll do a second version of that. So you were asking some like highlights of my career, and you know, I just like to learn all the time. So for example, I learned all this bioinformatics, how to run bioinformatics tools, how to like do the data wrangling using R, like a data visualization. But then the next step for me will be learning some like machine learning approaches, right? So conventional statistical learning, like for example, like linear regression, random forest, logistic regression, all this thing. So I started to actually learn that. And more recently, I started to learn like deep learning related stuff, like, you know, like generative AI. Like if you read my blog post, you will see many like contents about like those deep learning approaches. So I really love to learn those new things. And I think the sequel will be probably more like machine learning focused. So I put all this learning together. And I feel like there's so little actually textbook out there, like which is like bioinformatics focused and also using deep learning approaches. I bought several books, but they are very general, like high level. I really want something hands-on. And the way that I am learning is that I will actually read the textbook, but then the example will be very different from the biology. It will be like movie review, like a sentiment analysis, like whatever, like product recommendation. It's very different, but I will read the book and adapt that code. And I will first actually run the code using their example, get familiar with the model. What does that mean? Like, where are the parameters that I can fine tune? Then I will find the biological problem that I want to solve. And then I get the biology data and then adapt the code to that biology problem. And then I write a blog post and then see, okay, how it works. And then eventually I will need to do a project using deep learning, for example, like in your company, like you're using generative AI to design antibodies. So for example, then I probably will all just find a project like that. Okay, let me try this and to see whether it can generate some sensible like results. Or I can replicate the published results like on using deep learning for bioinformatics. For example, recently we are really interested in like the T cell receptor sequencing data. Like how can we actually use deep learning to predict whether a specific TCR sequence is a tumor antigen specific or tumor reactive? So that's something I'm really interested in, and we're working on it.
Okay, maybe then follow up on that point. What does a director of computational biology do in a company like Immunitas?
Oh yeah, I guess like when you're a manager, your job actually has changed, and that actually takes me a long time to realize. So when I was in Dana-Farber, I was more like a manager because I need to manage a team. And I realized that I need to learn something more other than just the technical skills. For example, how to manage people, how to motivate them, how to make the meeting more organized and things like that. So it's a different learning, like it's more like a leadership management. So I took a lot of courses on that as well. So if you look at my LinkedIn, like the first like several years, I took a lot of like bioinformatics class, statistics class. Then you'll say, okay, suddenly I'm taking like management class, like leadership by coaching sessions. And as a director of computational biology, like in a small biotech, don't take me wrong, I still need to do hands-on analysis, right? Then, but more importantly, as a manager, your responsibility is to actually empower your teammates, empower your direct reports to be their best version. How you can also even hire the best people for the right task, because you realize even I am good, but I can only accomplish so much. But with a team that is working together so efficiently, you can actually accomplish a much, much bigger goal. And your job is really to help your direct reports to be successful. And eventually, when they are successful, you are successful. And I can talk a little bit more like specifically what the job looked like. So computational biology, I still consider myself as a biologist. So I can formulate the biological question that to ask. Then I use computational tools or methods to address that question. And at Immunitas, we work really closely with the immunology team. So we have a wet lab team here. And we also generate single cell data actually in-house, single cell RNA sequencing and single cell TCR sequencing data in-house. And we will talk actually really frequently with each other. And we sit actually next to each other and we can ask questions and chat with each other. And when the sequencing data comes, then we will analyze data. And during the data analysis process, we will also ask them for suggestions. Is this results making sense? And we also recently got this Merck scope or the VisGene from VisGene, the spatial transcriptome platform. So we are also generating some of the spatial transcriptome data. And we are using that to do a target validation to see, okay, whether that gene is expressed in certain cell types and what are the neighboring cell types that are interacting with that cell type. So there's some exciting science going on like in the company. So, yeah.
Yeah. Would you say that, especially the last bit, the technical aspect of the work you do, is it more towards target discovery?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So my job actually was initially to do new target identification. And since now we have our clinical trial going on, the phase one clinical trial, so we are getting many of those biomarker data. So Matt Bursting and me, and now the computational team is also supporting analysis of those data, like flow cytometry, nanostring, TCR sequencing. They're not as complicated, flow cytometry. They're not as complicated as, for example, like single cell data, but it's very exciting to see those data from patients and you're dosing those patients using your drug and you hope to see some biomarker changes. And it's just very exciting to see that. And you feel like you are making an impact really close to the bed. Yeah.
It's a moment, I think, where you need to, you know, to congratulate yourself and everybody else in the team. It's not that common for a company, a startup especially, to go through all of the IND and start a clinical trial. However, like you said, your job doesn't finish there. There will be other programs in the pipeline. And also, would you say that some of the work you do has an implication on the design of the clinical trials, like patient stratification based on biomarker data?
Yeah, exactly. So I think for the success of a trial, I think most important thing is to recruit the right patient. And for those biomarker, like you want to recruit, for example, our CD161 antibody. Like for it to work, you need to have CD161 expressed in those tumors, just like PD-1 and PD-L1. People check the expression of PD-1, PD-L1 in the tumors. Like then the computational work we did is that, okay, we can, for example, get some tissue microarrays and from across different cancer types and then get the protein expression data and then to see which maybe cancer type is enriched for the expression of, for example, the CD161 and also its ligand CLEC2D, just like PD-1 and PD-L1. And we also mine a public available RNA sequencing data, like for TCGA, and we check all those data. And also single cell data is also available, public available. So we curated a lot of data from the public domain. And we also have an internal SNCMIC pipeline to process them. And so we can ask this question, okay, where is CD161 is expressed in which cell type and how the expression level is compared across different cancer types. Then we can kind of prioritize which tumor indication we want to go after in our clinical trial. Yeah. And since we are now getting all those biomarker data, it will be really nice for us to also to derive a biomarker that we can actually pre-select those patients who are most likely to respond to the drug. Yeah. Yeah, that's something in the future. Yeah.
A lot of things that you mentioned, I think, has a place in academia as well. But obviously not everything. What would you do? And this is a question from the audience. What would be your advice for computational biologists who are making the transition from academia to industry?
Okay. Actually, I made a video just for that. If you want to make the transition, you can go to my YouTube. And so I guess there are many transferable skills that you can use. Like, so for example, if you collaborate with other labs, and then how to collaborate is very important in industry. So I think in academia, people are really, for example, like they look really heavy on this single paper. Okay, I need to be the first author. Like they're competitive. But in a company, in the industry setting, it's all about like working together, actually collaborative, like in a wide environment, so that you can make the advancement of your program. So I think collaboration, and also communication is very important. So because in different departments, you have to, for me, like I have to talk to like the web biologist, the antibody engineer team, the translational biomarker team. So that actually can be a difficult job. So if you don't know the language for different departments, so it's also a big learning process for me as well. Like that's why staying in a small company, you get the chance to see the whole process of the drug development, and you got to talk to different functions of the department. And I feel like I learned quite a bit. So you get to hear all those like synonyms. You never like hear them before. Like, oh, what does that mean? Right. So you just like keep learning. And I think that's my suggestion, that is practice your communication skills, also collaborate with other people, and you should be really well organized, no matter whether you're in academia or in industry. So you need to set your goals really clearly. So for like a PhD, like, oh, I need to publish paper like before I graduate, right? Then the same thing, like in the industry, okay, I need to achieve a certain goal in a certain period of time. And of course you can break down to small, like short-term goals or long-term goals, but you got to have some goal setting process and prioritization process. Those skills were actually really useful for you to be in the industry as well. Yeah.
I have a few related questions from the audience, and I'll apply that to something I have in mind. So you've been exposed to biology, transition to bioinformatics, and now experimenting with ML/AI methods and publishing, you know, content about that too. In your opinion, in the next 3, 5, 10 years, you paint a picture for us. How would you say that AI ML will play a role in the future of bioinformatics or genomics?
Yeah, in terms of drug development, I think AI is still in its early stage. As far as I know, there are several AI designed, maybe small molecules or like any large molecules, anybody. They're in like clinical trial, like maybe early clinical trial, phase one or phase two. But we haven't seen probably any drugs that is on market. It's contributed largely by the AI. But AI definitely will play a really important role. So you got to learn it, how those machine learning and deep learning approaches. And it can actually accelerate the speed of new drug development and new drug identification for sure. One of the big hurdles is that we don't have enough data or good quality or high quality data yet. For example, like for deep learning models to train, you want to have like millions of data points and in order for it to be really accurate. But the reality is that we don't have that much high quality data yet. So in the case of like a protein engineer or like an antibody engineer, we just don't have enough data there yet. So, but I think if we have enough data, those AI models definitely can play a role to speed up the whole drug development process. And I firmly believe that. So be ready now, start to learn now, and then when the data is ready, and then you can apply them. So I would say, if I build a company, it will be always platform first, then AI on top, which means the platform can generate a lot of high throughput, high quality, and label the data. And then you build your AI infrastructure on top of that, then you can train your model on top of that. Then you can probably find some good drug targets and maybe even new drugs from those models. Yeah.
That's great for the target discovery to molecule discovery to all the way to optimization. Mm-hmm. But what would you say about the later stages? That seems to be a big bottleneck for a lot of biopharma, clinical trials, FDA approval, and so on. Do you see any change in that space?
Yeah, so if I look at the whole process of the drug development, so you have this like preclinical stage, like new target discovery, then hits to leads, then leads optimization. It's a long process. Then preclinical models, like mouse models, then clinical trials. I would say the clinical trial, my experience, is the bottleneck, because it usually just takes years of work. And it's not only whether your drug works or not. It's also about regulatory thing, like whether the government has like regulatory, like, you know, things on this, like how you can recruit patients. What you should not have this like exclusion criteria, and it just takes very time to actually coordinate with different sites, like different cancer centers, hospitals. It's a lot of work, and how you actually efficiently recruit the right patients, that may be also another bottleneck. So I don't know, maybe in the future all the patients, so because the sequencing price is going to be dropped so dramatically, so maybe every patient will will get sequenced their genome. They can easily like match to the right trial they want to get on, like just based on their genetics information, based on their like their medical record. The AI thing can also play a role there, like to actually recruit the right patients more efficiently. Yeah.
Good. I have one more question.
Okay.
So if you weren't doing what you are doing now, what else you would do?
That's a very good question. Someone actually asked me this before, and my answer was probably a little bit surprising. I want to be a barber, like, you know, just cutting hairs for other people. And by the way, I did this like by myself, like my haircut. And I think it's an enjoyable work because when you do a really good job, people look more confident about themselves. And if they are smiling, they are confident, and I'm adding value to them, and I'm happy. So, yes, I will be a barbershop.
I appreciate that connecting thread in your thoughts that, yeah, I got to give back to community, do something for the society. Do you have any closing remarks?
Yes. So I just for the whole community, I think we mentioned the data is still one of the bottlenecks for training like machine learning models. But still, there are so many like data silos like in the industry. People hold their data. They don't want to share their data. The same thing even in academia, right? If you read a paper, you probably will see this line, the data are available upon reasonable request, which is what is reasonable request, right? So the same with industry, like we really need to have a culture to share the data. Of course, it's not like private data. Like at least you can de-identify those data. And for example, Recursion recently, they just like mapped billions of like chemical and protein interactions based on their structure. But then like, can you share the model a little bit? What's the transparency of the model? Like, and we really want to know like whether the model really works. And if you can share the data, that'll be even more useful for other people, maybe have a different purpose, right? And the same for clinical trial data, right? It's most useful data. But many companies, like big pharma companies, when they carry out trials, and even those failed trials, those data are really, really meaningful because you need to figure out why that trial failed, right? But then usually when the trial failed, they will just freeze the data. No one have access. And then it's just a waste of resource, right? Those are so valuable. And we still need to figure out a system how to share those data and how other people can utilize those data more efficiently. Yeah. So that's like just my final remark. Yeah.
Well, as someone who listened to this conversation, I think we would all agree that you proved your mother's point that knowledge can really change your destiny. Thank you very much for joining us. It was really pleasant to have you here.
Thank you very much, Murat. It's my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Future of Drug Discovery, brought to you by Murat, the co-founder and CEO at Antiverse and the production team here at Antiverse. We value your support immensely, and to help us continue growing this vibrant community, we kindly ask you to like, rate, and review the podcast. Your feedback fuels our mission for a better connected community. This episode is a recording of our monthly live events. After each event, we host a 90-minute networking session where the most fruitful conversations are had. It's the perfect opportunity to meet other community members and connect with industry experts. To be notified about our future events, follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter or opt in for email updates using the form in the episode show notes. We hope to see you at the next event. Until next time.